Blog Talk Radio.
Crazy weather here in the States, huh? Oh, I think, well, it came from the West, and, well, we didn't exactly New York City. We didn't get any snow, but we got definitely lots of rain, and, yeah, so it's raining today. It's not raining men. It's raining rain. But I'm in inside, and it's warm here, thank goodness. And so I get to do this radio show and have some great guests this evening. So let me tell you, about this show. Well, I had gone to Talbot County, Maryland, which appears to have a lot to offer. Aside from its location at the Chesapeake Bay. And, well, there's a whole bunch of, not a bunch, let's say five or six, like, small towns in the area, each with its own, how do you say it? Well, you know, just not things to do, but it's, you know, the atmosphere, et cetera, you know. But anyway, so Easton is, like, I guess if you want to call, like, the capital, I guess that's where this the city seat is, or county, the county seat, and also where there's lots of things to do. And so one of the things in Easton to do is to attend a theater that called the Avalon Theater, which has some not only great performers, but great history. And so Tim will be coming on to discuss about the past and present. Yes, he'll present the present. Interesting, huh? Spelled the both the same. And, well, it's nothing like fresh from the farm dairy, huh? Yeah. Well, Holly Foster from Chapel's Country Creamery will take us through the steps and telling us how she cuts the cheese. Yes, and as well as talk about those lovely cows that provide the milk. And then lastly, oh yeah, dining. Chef Jordan Lloyd. He's the owner of the Bartlett Pear Inn, also in Easton, and he's going to discuss how he gets the local foods as well as the menu. But needless to say, well, you know. Well, I want to start with, I usually start with my food sponsor. I'll do that a little later because I have one that's back with us. Abel Orr.
ACL, anterior cruciate ligament. The tear will bring tears, and while the rest of your team may be taking a knee, you'll be grasping yours. Anterior cruciate ligament will feel more like anterior excruciating ligament. You hear that loud pop and feel the pain. Your knee swells as you are assisted off the field and an ice pack is applied. For some, the pain and swelling will subside and may simply become a minor nuisance. For others, a significant disability. Able Orthopedic and Sports Medicine can bring you back in the game, specializing in arthroscopic ACL knee reconstruction surgery. It's a minimally invasive procedure that rarely requires hospitalization. With healing, recovery, and appropriate therapy and rehabilitation, you could be returning next season. Let Able Orthopedic return the able in disable. Able Orthopedic and Sports Medicine is located at 76-55 Austin Street in Forest Hills, New York. Call them at 718-897-2228 or visit them at their website at www.ableorthopedic.com. Able Orthopedic asks, how's your ACL?
Yeah, well, it's not my ACL that's bothering me. I got a hip problem. I think I'm going to get in touch with them and see if I can have them take care of it. And maybe afterwards I'll be yelling, hip, hip, hooray. But in the meantime, look who's here. Yes, that's Esther. Oh, and wait a minute. They have okay. Esther just told me don't forget about Marilyn and Minerva. Yep, the four of them went on coincidentally the same trip that I did to Talbot County. It's in their blog. Esther and Eunice Adventures, .blogspot.com. You should check it out there to see, what they did. They seem to have a good time. Considering Marilyn being a kleptomaniac there, but it's okay. Minerva, handles her so she doesn't take too much. I don't know. I'm waiting for Tim from the Avalon Theater to call in, and let me give you the gist of this road trip. I took the road trip. I went with Lori Katz, and she did the driving as well as assisting me in writing stuff. I tend to not get indulged as much on things and pick up all the info. She more or less asks more questions than I do, and that's fine. We drove from New York City, going through New Jersey and Delaware and into Maryland, where we hit the Talbot County and went directly to Easton. And interestingly enough, when we got to Easton, we wanted to get everything clear so we could deal with the itinerary, and we stopped in at the tourism office there. And in front of the tourism office was this bus known by the Graskels. And in case you haven't heard who the Graskels are, which I will at some point have on my radio show, the Graskels are a bluegrass country. Bluegrass? Yeah. Singing group, and I got to see them at the Avalon, and we went around Easton to several places, and of course I will have some of these people on the show later. Let me see if I can why this always happens. Somebody forgets. Let's see if I can get a phone number here. Okay. What I will do, I'll tell you what, how about that while I'm trying to get in touch with these people, I play a song, okay? Let me pull up. Okay. Well, since I'll tell you what, since Melba Moore is going to be doing a show, let's get Melba Moore song. Why the heck not? The song is called Love It. Number and see what happens. I don't know if I have to have, okay, one, you know, let me see if it, area code, 401, let's see, and we got 822, okay, and let's go to dial. Okay. Let's hope I don't get the box office. Of course, we're going to get the leave a voicemail, right?
Hi, you've reached 822-0345. Sorry to say we can't come to the phone right now, but if you leave your name, number, and a brief message, we'll get back to you right away. Thank you.
Hi, this is Merle Exit calling. I don't know where Tim is, but Tim's supposed to be on my radio show right now. If you get this call-in number, in case you forgot, 646-478-0077. Thanks. Bye. Let's see. Hang up. Okay. Well, I don't know. Okay. I can talk a little about it. I can't talk about the past of the whole thing, But basically, it's a theater that's in downtown. It's a very old theater. And I'm sure they had, like, maybe probably movies or whatnot years ago. But what they have there, it's the is the entertainment center, kind of. So they'll have, well, let me see if I could pull. Let's see who's going to be up on the Avalon Theater. Let's see if we get, okay, let's do the old Google. No, okay, let's try this. Avalon, A-V-A-L-O-N, Avalon, T-H-E-A-T-R-E, Theater in E-A-S-T-O-N, and let's see what we can get. Okay, Avalon Theater, Theater. Okay, got the Avalon Theater. That's the box office. Avalon Theater, that's the tickets. How about, let's go. Let's try. Avalon. Oh, come on, really? Oh, here we have. AvalonTheater.com. Okay, let me just make sure. Nope, still haven't called it. Get back. Okay, all right. So, let's see. I'll tell you what's coming up there. No, come on. You touch something with the, you know, you touch thing, everything goes off. Okay, so, let's see. The Fix, F-I-X-X. Let's see, Jimmy Greenspoon event from Murray Wood Foundation, Doug Womble's solo, Driven to Clarity, an evening with Veronu, Elijah presented by Eastern Choral Art Society, Austin Ellis with Sean Cheesham. Okay, so I'm getting that this is pretty much a lot of, like, country music that goes on there. So that's what we kind of, although, now, this is the Metropolitan Opera. Now, they're probably, well, here it says that the Avalon Theater, there's a showplace of the Eastern Shore, from the symphony to bluegrass, comedians to art festivals. Okay. The Metropolitan Opera, they're probably going to have something like, I don't know if they're going to have it directly, but it's like, this event company that does that too. But anyway, so I guess we're just not going to get the person from the Avalon Theater. Okay. Well, I certainly tried. So let's go. I'll tell you what. Hopefully we'll get the person. We'll get Holly Foster. In about, that's only got about 10 minutes before she calls. And so, now, speaking of Melba Moore, who will be appearing, actually, she'll be in upstate New York, I think this weekend, but she'll be at the Apollo Theater in New York, at the end of May. So it happens I'm going to play one of my favorite songs from the show Hair, which she was in. And you'll probably, if you've ever heard of Melba Moore sing, you will recognize her voice. And this is a song called The Flesh Failures. Monday, I have some of the artists calling in to talk about the art walk. And we stayed overnight at the Tidewater Inn, which was like this catty corner from, catty corner from the Avalon Theater. And was a lovely place. It was a lovely place. I'm laughing because I had a room. Room was nice. The bed was really tall. I don't know why they make beds like this. I have no idea. I guess maybe so you could store stuff underneath, maybe. But it was so high. How high was it? It was so high. I mean, I had to go on those old-fashioned, like, step stools. Like, one step was enough. I had to go really to the second step to get up onto the bed. I didn't have as much problem getting off the bed. You know, I can see, slide off the bed. But, getting up there was, that was something else. I was wondering, more concerned about, oh, my God, what if I need to use the ladies' room? would I get out of there quick enough? But we didn't get much of a chance to explore the hotel itself, because we checked in, and just went ahead into the room to go to sleep, kind of thing. We didn't have breakfast there because we're often the next day to another destination. As a matter of fact, where did we go? The next destination, we're going into a different town of St. Michael's. We did return later on to Easton for a few other things. Let's see. What did we do? Let's go to here. Come on here. We returned to Easton because we were having dessert at this place, Oxford Green's Home Store and Market Restaurant. Now, it just so happened that we popped in there because we wanted to, like, grab a bite to eat, and such an oddity in that from the outside, you would just think it's some, home store market, and inside there's all these antiques that they sell. Antiques, aside from food, and they're big on desserts. I had their tiramisu, and it's really good. The tiramisu, it was like, I like the consistency of the area of the mascarpone, that whole thing. Not that this is a negative thing, but I didn't get any sense of the use of alcohol to soak the lady fingers. But then it's not, like, required. Like, some people, sometimes they soak it in rum, sometimes they soak it in Kahlua is usually the thing, because Kahlua is, like, for the coffee taste. So sometimes they just soak it in coffee for the coffee taste. But anyway, that was excellent. Lori had a chicken salad sandwich. I didn't get a taste of it. She said it was yummy. And where else we went? Back in town, we had lunch at a place called Mason's. We had, well, I guess it was more brunch-ish, even though it was a Tuesday. I had this really, really great quiche. Oh, wow. I forgot what was in there. I have to look at the photo. I remember it had, there was goat cheese in it. There was all kinds of peppers. There was, I think it was chicken in it. I'm not sure. That's what it kind of looked like. I'm going to have to check it out. Of course, having the chicken there, Esther and Eunice didn't want to have any part of that. But Mason's seems to be not only, there's like a separate store that abuts it, that where they sell, I guess, gourmet stuff and chocolates in particular. Chocolate. Okay. And then I didn't get the opportunity. I will have them on a later show because I didn't get the opportunity because we wanted to at some point get back to New York. But anyway. All right. So what we're going to do now is get in our next guest here. Okay. Holly, do I have you?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, Holly, I'm so glad. it was such a... The Avalon Theater was supposed to call in at 4, and they just forgot, I guess.
Uh-oh.
I don't know. But anyway, but we got you.
All right.
Okay, so first... What I want to talk, okay, first just give us an overall view of, like, who you are and what you do.
All right. Well, my husband and I have 112 acres in Talbot County, and we raise and milk Jersey cows and their calves, and we do rotational grazing, so they get a new fresh grass lot every day, sometimes twice a day. And then we turn their milk into cheese and yogurt.
Wow. Okay. So first of all, let's before we get into the whole thing, let's talk about the cows. Why did you choose Jersey cows? Just curious. And,
right.
And
well,
does it make a difference?
Yes,
does it
does.
Make a difference on the type of cows you have when you're getting products like cheese?
I think so. Yes. My husband grew up on a farm and was familiar with the Holstein, your typical dairy cow that produces, a lot of milk. And I didn't grow up on a farm, and I just like the looks of a Jersey cow. They just look so cute with their big brown eyes and their long eyelashes. So the side of me, and they're also a smaller frame cow, they're a smaller cow. So I asked him that before we got into this, that I would like to milk Jerseys, and he said he liked Holstein. So we started out with a mixed herd of both. But as he started milking, he realized, the Jerseys were better grazers, and we knew we wanted to be, as much grazing as possible, that their butter fat in their milk is also higher and richer. But they don't produce as much milk as a Holstein does, but the butter fat's higher, which is a greater yield for your cheese. And they just seem to be kind of laid back. I think their birthing ease is a lot better, too. You usually have to help out a Holstein sometimes more so having a calf than you do a Jersey. So that's a little less labor on the farm-wise.
Well, when it comes to something like butter fat, mm-hmm. How does, like, try to explain, how does that work? I mean, like, how does that, first of all, they got two stomachs, correctly? Am I correct?
That's about right, yeah.
Okay. And
two to four, yeah.
Now, how does it, like, they're munching on grass, right?
Yes.
Okay. How does the grass know which stomach to go to?
Oh, well, it's just a processed digestion system, just like ours. It just goes from one chamber to the next. But the one thing that a cow does, they're designed to graze and to go around and chomp up all this grass like a lawnmower. And then they kind of set it off to the side in one chamber of their stomach. And then when they go to lay down is when they bring it out of that chamber And that's when they chew their cud is what it's called. And that's when they really start chewing and chewing. And they chew like a mouthful over 30 sometimes, and then they swallow it. And that'll go into another part of their stomach where it then continues to digest. So they bring it up out of their pouch. So that's kind of different. So when the cows are laying down, it doesn't mean it's going to rain. It just means that they're full, they're done grazing all that they want to get at that moment, and that they're digesting their what they've clipped, if you will. And then it continues to digest from there. But it's neat that they can bring that back up, mouthful at a time, what they set aside.
Okay. Now, I'm curious, let's say if a cow, let's say, was on its own, you know, and it just and it ate grass just because it was surviving, let's say, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
What, I mean, would milk continue to just
no,
pile up?
Well, a cow has a cycle just as a human does in a way. So with that, when a cow has a calf is when she comes into her milk, so that she has milk for that calf as soon as it's born.
Oh.
And then when that calf, as you know, the cow's body is designed to produce more milk as that calf grows to a certain point, which is around 100 days, you know, and then it's going to drop off. So the cow comes into her milk, and she increases the amount of milk that she produces, and then she hits that certain point, and then she starts to drop off. Because at that point in that calf's life, it's going to be eating other things other than milk. It's going to be grazing, eating grass or hay.
Right.
So then the cow can start, you know, cutting back on her milk because the calf is. So when it comes through that cycle, it will continue to drop off until she pretty much dries herself off, until she has another calf. So, but on the dairy farm, we give these cows 2 months off out of the year. So a cow is pregnant for 9 months, and then she has her calf, and then she starts her milk cycle, and then she peaks up, and then she hits that point, and then she'll start to drop off. And in that drop-off time is when she'll get pregnant again, and then she'll have 2 months of rest before she has her next calf. She does not milk. She gets to just lay around and relax. And then when she has her calf again is when she goes back to work of producing milk again.
Okay. So it's kind of like in terms of like a human being, that a human being is not, the female is not going to actually produces milk when the, just because the baby is born.
That is correct.
Ah, that's really interesting. Okay. So it's
so a cow has to have a calf before she will produce any milk. If she never has a calf, she'll never produce a drop of milk.
Wow, yeah, I didn't even know that.
Mm-hmm.
That must be why that, okay, there's something about, in the kosher law, about why you're not supposed to mix meat and milk, and there's something having to do with something, the mother's milk or some kind of thing. I forgot to look it up.
A mother at that point.
Right, okay, got it, okay. So now let's get into, what I saw, one day old? Or that's the same day?
I think it was a day old.
Day old. And then there was that one running around.
It was
2 or 3 days old?
Yes.
That was so cute.
Yeah.
Absolutely adorable. Okay, so now, approximately how many cows do you have?
Well, we're milking 54 right now in the parlor, and then we have probably about 15 or so that are, quote-unquote, on their two-month off time. It's called dry cow, so they're just kind of hanging out and relaxing. This is their time off. And they'll start coming in, you know, in the next few weeks, because we do like to have most of our cows have their calves in the springtime, and that way the grasses are all out and they're out there grazing. And it's a great time to make the cheese is when the cows are on the grass. They get those nice, fresh, young grasses that have the omega-3s in it, and it does go into their milk, which in turn then goes into the cheese, and it has a great flavor to it, too. It's just a spring, fresh flavor.
And as far as, like, would milk, like, I'm a milk person, will milk taste different at different farms due
it
to the cows?
It can, a little bit, yes. It can vary a little on what the cows are eating, and the time of the year also can predict, you know. So then sometimes everybody that, you know, they say that's kind of what puts the word artisanal in small-scale people's artisanal cheese places, because the breeds of their cows are a little different. Their grasses on my farm is going to be different than the grasses on somebody else's farm, and then the whole process part of it. So each cheese can be a little different, and our cheeses do change a little bit seasonally. Winter cheese is definitely different than your summer cheese. And the summer cheeses, because the cows are out, your spring, summer, and fall, your cows are out on the grass and all, the cheese color is darker. It's more of a buttery color. It's a nice, pretty yellow color. The milk is darker. It's almost like the yolk of an egg. The darker the yolk of the egg, the more nutritional value is in there. With the milk, it's the same thing. So you're going to have whiter milk in the wintertime when they're just getting fed hay, and opposed to the green grasses that are out there growing fresh that they're eating.
So, but when we have something like a cheddar cheese that's orange in color,
mm-hmm.
is that an additive?
Yes, that's a food dye called an annetto. It's just a food dye that they add to it. So, you know, the food coloring adds no different in flavor, and there's a lot of people out there that would argue that with me that aren't in the cheese business and don't know the process of cheese making, that the people say, I only like orange cheeses or yellow, quote-unquote yellow cheeses, when there are so many different cheeses out there. But the color, believe it or not, has nothing to do with the flavor, because it is a flavorless food coloring that goes in there.
Now,
it's derived from a plant, so it is, you know, it's kind of on the natural side.
Oh, okay.
We just don't ever add that because we just feel it's just something that's not needed.
Now, the term American cheese versus cheddar cheese?
Mm.
They both kind of look the same. What's the difference?
That is a good question. I have to say that American cheese isn't always just made from 100% milk and that's it, you know, other than your salt and your culture, which turns the milk into cheese itself. American cheese, I think, has other stuff in it, because when you look at American cheese package, it's actually going to say processed cheese food.
Right.
So they have to put that on there. So that doesn't mean it's 100% cheese directly from grade A milk. You know, it's got other, should I say, stuff in it.
Right.
That really, you know, how should I put it?
Makes it melt better.
Yes, it probably has goodies added into that. So, you know, pasteurized processed American cheese, that sometimes has other, I don't know how to put that, because I'm not sure what actually goes in that, other than it's completely different than your block of cheddar that just has milk, culture, and salt, because that's what makes up cheese.
Right.
But for some reason, the kids go for, because it's a milder, smoother, creamier, they're going to look for, you know, they like the smooth, you know, American cheese.
Right, I understand. I remember growing up on Velveeta until I tasted other cheeses, and I went, ooh, what was I eating?
Right, exactly. You know, my husband in the very beginning, you know, grew up in a household where they had the Kraft slices and the Velveeta, and he told me, you know, I don't like cheese, and I'm like, you what? So, and then we started going to these classes, and I started getting them, you know, more cultured, I should say, and then he had no idea. He was like, wow, this is great, you know? He's like, this is real cheese. I'm like, yeah, big difference between that. And I'm not saying it's not real cheese. It is real cheese. It's just a different style. So, you know.
So you got cultured about culture.
Yes, culture and different cheeses, right. And there's so many different cheeses out there.
What the process, how cheese is made. And then I want to talk about why do cheeses differ? But okay. First, let's get the basic.
Okay.
So tell me how you, you know, do cheese.
Okay. Well, here on our farm, we bring the cows up in the morning. My husband will bring them up and bring them in the parlor and all, and I'll be on the other side. He'll sanitize the dairy equipment. I'll sanitize the cheese equipment. And then when he starts putting the milkers on the cow, the milk comes through the pipeline through a filter, and it goes right into our cheese vat. So the milk comes in at a nice 94-ish degree temperature. And depending on what kind of cheese you're going to be making is what temperature you need it at. So sometimes you need to heat it up more for, like, cheddars, or if you're going to pasteurize it for a fresh cheese like mozzarella or a feta or something like that. But the next step of processing, I should say, the first thing you do is you add culture to your milk. Now, the culture is it's like a little tiny powder-like substance, almost like adding yeast to your bread.
Right.
And there's thousands of different cultures, but there's so many different types of cheese, too. So with that, that's where artisanal comes into play also, because the cheesemaker can choose different cultures for your different cheeses. So
right.
There isn't just one culture for cheddar, one culture for feta, one culture for brie. There's combinations, and then you can come up with your own culture cocktail, if you will, that will kind of set your cheese aside from everyone else's. And you can kind of develop your own flavor and your own, you know, makeup of, and even design your own cheese. You know, it doesn't really have to fall in a certain category. So with that, you know, you can really get artsy, I should say, with your product. And after you put your culture in and it gets used to the wet, warm environment, it's the good bacteria in there that starts growing and multiplying that you can't see. So it still looks just like milk, you know, but it's very busy. So how we tell the next stage is by taking a pH, and when the pH starts dropping is when you can tell it's time to put your rennet in. And then when you put your rennet in, rennet is the product that actually starts to curdle your milk, and it'll change it from a liquid to a semi-solid, almost like a custard-like consistency. And that's when you see the real changes in it. And once you put that in there and it stays in there for 45 minutes to an hour or so, and I'm just kind of going briefly over sort of a recipe that we follow. Every cheese is a little different on that, depending on the cheese.
Sure.
Then you cut your curd, and this is where your curd and whey will separate after you cut your curd down in small cubes. And again, depending on what kind of cheese you're making, is the size of curd you're looking for. The higher moisture cheeses and the more denser cheeses, it depends on the size of your curd, the larger or small. So you cut it all up in cubes, and then your whey will start coming from the cubes that you've cut, which is just the liquid. And it's a kind of a yellowish, liquidy substance that comes from the cheese itself. Now, whey is also reused. It's a really good high-protein item that, you know, larger cheese plants, you know, even smaller ones, can reuse that. Sometimes they'll feed it to the calves. Sometimes they'll have pigs. They'll feed it to the pigs. It's very sweet, very nutritious. Larger cheese plants will dehydrate it, and you'll have whey powder protein. And then you can also, they make drinks from it too, which would be like your Yoo-hoo. The main ingredient in that is whey, coming from mainly, I'm sure, cheese making. So it's definitely a byproduct that can be reused again. So, and most cheese making is when you drain your whey off of your curd, you have curds left, and that you put them in your cheese mold. Some are square, some are round, some are oblong, some are very large, like, you know, 40 to 100 pounds, and then some of them are very tiny, like goat cheese. They come into these little tiny round wheels, you know, they can be very tiny, and you can do individual, you know, wrapping of all that. So after the cheese, the curds get put in the molds and they drain. Some of them get put in presses, like Cheddar's, Colby's, and Jack's. They'll be put in a cheese press overnight, which will expel more of the whey out of it. So it's a more denser, solid cheese. And then
right.
Some cheeses like your Blue and like our Chapelle, a triple cream or a brie, those cheeses are not put in a cheese press. They get put into a mold that has little holes in it that the whey will continue to expel out naturally. And then they're already formed into their little shape that they need to be, and then they just age and they're done, good to go. Another thing, I guess, with cheeses, depending on the cheese that you're doing, if you're doing cheddar cheese and I'm trying to think of another one, mainly cheddar, would be, you would put your salt in the curd before it goes into the cheese mold.
Okay.
And then sometimes with other cheeses, you would do a dry salt, which was you would rub salt around the outside of the wheel after the cheese has been removed from the cheese mold, and that's like a dry rub, and then the cheese kind of soaks up that salt from the outside. And then there's another one, you could do a washed rind, which is after the cheese has become into the solid form that you want it in, you can wash it with different things, and including beer or wine or other products. Oh, you can put it in a brine, which would be a saltwater brine, and that's the way the cheese would incorporate the salt in it after it's even already in a wheel.
Okay, so that my first question is with the rinds.
Yes.
Can you eat the rinds of cheese?
Some, yes. Yes, some cheeses. And that's a good question, too, because there's different rinds to cheeses. Some cheeses, after being taken out of the cheese mold or the cheese press, it sometimes can get packaged up and then it can finish aging in a walk-in, vacuum sealed, and then it won't develop a rind on it. It'll be rindless, which most of your cheddars are rindless. They don't have a rind to them. Some cheddars, more on the artisanal side, would be like a cloth-bound cheddar, which I'm not real familiar with those, but, you know, they age with a cloth around them, and they'll actually develop a nice little rind to it. Others are put, like, in an open aging room where in the aging room hasn't been inoculated, if you will, with good bacteria, and depending on the bacteria that's in that aging room, is depending on what kind of rind you're going to end up with, whether it's a nice, bloomy rind like a brie, or kind of a washed rind, you know, like it's got, you know, you can get like beautiful orange smear rinds that have like, you know, bee linens in it. So cheese is full of good bacteria that, you know, that we put in the cheese making business, but also that it develops the rind on them. All of our rinds that we make here are edible. They're all, you know, taken care of in situations where it adds more flavor to the cheese. But
right.
Some rinds, you know, of course you don't want to eat a wax rind. Yeah, some cheeses are dipped in wax and it preserves them and it keeps the moisture
in
them. Right. And some of them are natural rinds. So it's almost like a personal preference of whether you like the rind. The rind would be stronger.
Right.
Cheese ages from the outside, which would be the rind, in. So that's why sometimes when you have a softer cheese, it's even like a brie, you would even have a really soft, creamy right underneath the rind, and then it'll kind of get a little harder and more dense towards the center of it. That would be the same for like a triple cream too.
Okay.
I always eat the rinds on all of those.
Now, just so I, when you did, in terms of a soft cheese and a hard cheese, I just wanted just quite clear or not clear, is it, if a hard cheese means that more whey is gone from it?
Yes.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
So the more whey you take out,
the
you know, that's
the denser the cheese, right. And the higher the moisture, the more whey has been kept in that, in the cheese-making process, yes.
Okay. So,
and also, too, that goes with aging, you know. You know, most of those, like a brie cheese, is aged a lot less than a cheddar cheese is. So they're going to be, but it's really mainly in your cheese-making process that will allow that moisture to stay in.
So since, like, whey is good for you, like, you know, because they make the powder and stuff like that, I guess, healthier for you to be eating a soft cheese than a hard cheese?
Wow, you got me on that one.
Oh, okay.
I have no idea.
That's the old Google. That's what.
Yeah. Let's do that. I have no idea.
That would be interesting to
find that out.
Although, for instance, I don't know, I remember something about in terms of they had this thing, regarding your blood type.
Uh-huh.
And it had something to the effect that, you can't have the soft cheese, you can have hard cheeses. And I thought, okay, I don't know what the difference is. Milk is milk, you know.
Uh-huh.
But it could be maybe it's the contents of the whey. I don't know.
I do know that if people are lactose intolerant, most people that aren't severely lactose intolerant tend to be able to handle older, harder cheeses, such as an aged cheddar. They can handle that, but they cannot handle the young, fresher, moisture cheeses. That is a known fact.
Okay. And in terms of what makes a cheese sharper?
Your culture, but also sometimes your aging. The longer you age it, the sharper your cheese is going to be, the stronger it becomes.
Okay.
But your culture will determine, too, on how much sharpness you'll have in it.
Okay. Also, in terms of, like, raw milk cheeses, is that it? Or just
raw milk cheeses.
Raw just means that
the milk
it's not...
has not been pasteurized.
Okay. But it could be homogenized.
Yes, it can be.
Okay. So homogenized is really kind of like mixing it, so to speak.
Yes.
As opposed to...
Right,
yes.
So you remove part of the fat from it, and then you mix it so that it stays separated out. So your cream isn't going to come to the top, if you will. If you see a homogenized glass of milk, it would be like the mixed. There, you cannot see the difference between cream and the milk. But the unhomogenized, there's a difference. If you put a glass of milk out, the cream will settle to the top.
Okay.
Old-fashioned, a lot of people, they used to, would get milk right out of the tank, or I remember when we had the family cow, and we would have the milk in the refrigerator. I hear stories like this all the time, and they would have the cream-top milk, and that's why you could see these glass bottle milk bottles.
Yeah.
They came with a spoon, and they would have a separate little section up top, and you could scoop the cream off. And
that's
I remember
funny.
Children, they say children would fight over who gets the cream.
I had remembered that when I was young, we got milk delivered.
Yes.
You got the glass bottle. It didn't mean there weren't any grocery stores. It was like a special thing,
that's right.
Get your milk delivered. And they were in bottles, and there was the cream on the top.
Yes.
Yeah, my mother opened up every one of them and took it and had it before we could.
Yeah, and the moms would usually do that. They would usually take that and bake with it, or they would put it in their coffee, or they would save it for other things. Yes.
Yeah, I wish that were possible. I'll tell you one thing. When it comes to milk, I can't deal. I mean, I could probably deal with 1% milk, but don't give me a skim milk. It's like you might as well just. Might as well just have a glass of water. I'm sorry.
Right. My kids say that all the time because they've grown up on the farm with the family cow, and they're used to that unhomogenized / cream top milk. So they stay the same. A lot of them say, I can't drink the milk at school.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So let's get into the products that you make. At least the ones that I was able to taste. And all were good, by the way.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Mm. Yes. So describe the ones that you have.
Okay. We have a Talbot Reserve, which is a one-year cheddar. And the cultures that we use in that, when it's finished, is not a real sharp cheddar. It's a mild cheddar. It still has, it's very creamy. And it has a natural rind to it, which gives it some earthy tone, some mushroomy, earthy tone flavors. And that's one of my biggest sellers. Then we have our Chapelle. That's a French-style, bloomy-rind cheese. It comes in a wheel, and we only age it for a little over 2 months, and it's a semi-hard cheese. It does not go into a press, and that's really good with, fruit. It's like a good dessert cheese. Local honey drizzled on it. Yes. It's good stuff. And then we have our Bay Blue. We named it after being so close to the Chesapeake Bay here. And that is like Stilton style blue. We make it about a 4.5 pound wheel.
Now, what exactly, so people know, what is blue cheese?
Blue cheese. Blue cheese has a blue mold culture in the milk itself. So there's another culture that will actually is in there that will create little air holes all through the cheese as it's aging, and in those air holes, the blue mold will actually grow. So after a certain amount of time, you'll be able to see the blue mold growing in it. It's a stronger cheese. Wow, there's so many different types of blue, but it's treated very similar to the Chapelle. You know, it doesn't get put in the cheese press. It ages a little over 3 months. With that, there are different aged cheeses of the blues itself. I'm not familiar with the different ones and how long they're aged, but you've got like a, you know, a Roque 40 and a Stilton, and wow, there's so many different ones. And they each have their own unique taste, which is kind of neat. So it's almost like wine, you know. You can pick a blue cheese, and there's such a wide spectrum of flavor you're going to get from each one. It's different. Falls in a medium on that.
How much difference in terms of, like, the aging or whatever, like a cheese, like a blue cheese where it's one that you crumble versus, not a pecorino, you know, Italian, one of the cheese that you grate.
Yes. Right. Okay, so blue cheese is not dense since it has the little air holes that makes it easier for it to crumble. And it's not put in a cheese press, so it's not considered what they call dense. Now, your cheddar cheese or like a good Parmesan, you know, they're a good solid cheese. You can grab a block and you can grate it, and it's going to grate out very nicely. Yes.
Okay.
The denser and
all right, let's continue.
Their age, they're older.
Let's continue with what you got.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. Then we have a new cheese that we started, and it's called Amber 16 Cheddar. And it's a young cheddar cheese that we started doing a washed rind on, where we actually wash the rind, the outside of the cheese block, with Amber 16 Ale. It's a amber ale from Georgetown, Delaware, from 16 Mile Brewery. And so we paired up with a local brewery and is using their beer for that. So that's a really neat, unique flavor that we've paired together, and that's turning out really well.
And let me ask you a question about that.
Mm-hmm.
Would that make a difference of what kind of beer that you use?
Yes, yes. You really
so you can actually come up with a whole line of beer cheeses.
That's exactly right. You could.
That's interesting.
Literally, exactly, you said it right there. You could almost have an entire line of different beers that you put on even the same cheese, and they're going to come out a little different.
Wow.
Yeah. Beer,
okay.
Wine, you know, all kinds of goodies. Yeah. Then we do a feta. We just started that last year. One is a plain feta. We call it Cordova White. And then we do a marinated Cordova White, in which it took third place at the American Cheese Society Conference competition last summer. And we were shocked with that. it's your basic pasteurized, young, fresh feta that's great in the summer to throw on your salad that we crumble up and put in little containers for convenience. And it's turned out real well.
Now,
very nice, young, fresh cheese.
Personally, for me, in terms of feta cheese,
mm-hmm.
Now you this is still the same coming from a cow, right?
Yes, most feta is from goat, but there are cow feta out there too.
I happen to prefer the cow feta, and I don't seem to find a lot of that.
Not a lot out there, right?
Or sheep, it's like sheep or goat, and I'm going, I just want a cow, you know. and what else? Talk about the yogurt.
Oh, okay.
Tell us about the yogurt.
Got it. Well, we do a cream top yogurt, and that means that the milk that we use in our yogurt is unhomogenized. So when we process the yogurt, we pasteurize the milk, and then we put in our culture, and then we pump it out into the containers while it was still in liquid form before it has turned into yogurt. And then we incubate those containers, and when we incubate those containers, the cream settles to the top in each individual container. So it's almost opening like a little dessert. And we usually just use local ingredients, like we do a honey yogurt that is our most popular one. The honey yogurt only has our fresh warm milk that we started with, yogurt culture, and local Maryland honey, and that is it. Just those three ingredients, and all local.
That was, like, so good.
Thank you.
And I'm not, and it, you know, it, and it's funny because sometimes when I'm using, even when I use honey, it doesn't, it seems sometimes like it's too strong.
Yes.
This one, like, just as if it basically sweetened
right.
the yogurt, and that's all it did.
Mm-hmm. It
not, and not giving
it
that strong honey flavor. That was, like, perfect.
Mm-hmm.
I got it. I hope you can make these things enough, because I'm going to try so hard to get it up here.
Sure.
At the Fairway Markets.
Understandable.
The tri-state area, really. There wasn't one, like, if you said which one did you like best, it was, I liked them all.
Right, right.
So,
yeah,
another
one. Vanilla bean, too, yeah.
The ones that I tasted are just what you were making now, kind of thing.
What was that? Say that again.
The ones that I tasted are not your entire.
That's correct.
Right.
Right. We're easing into the entire line of cheese and yogurts right now, yes.
Okay. So, in other words, if I was there, if I came back in like 3 or 4 months from now, would
I taste
different cheeses?
Not necessarily different cheeses. I think we hadn't made the feta for the season yet, but we're starting that next week.
Right.
And I do believe the day after you came and visited here, we made a batch of vanilla, so we had honey and vanilla yogurt. The one. So, yeah, we were just easing into our production for the spring here. So, yeah.
So, in other words, I might get a sample of that as well, huh?
Yes, that's correct.
But, I mean, those yogurts, I mean, have you made smoothies?
Yeah, I have. That's my children. I have to say that's probably one of their favorite after-school snacks. Smoothies with that. And then when the berries come in season, they throw a bunch of berries or even bananas in the wintertime and all. They'll throw whatever they want in the smoothie with the yogurt. And it's a favorite of theirs.
Wow. I could just imagine. I mean, I could, you know, like with the cheeses and the yogurt that you have, I could not necessarily have a glass of milk. I'll be fine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because, I mean, the milk products themselves that you have are just, it's so good.
I think I kind of tend to think that because of the way we do things around here, we keep our herd to a small size, and it makes us micromanage so much better. We can really pay attention to things. And I like to think of our dairy herd is like a classroom. There's only so many kids in a classroom you can take care of where they each get individual care. And of course, you can add more teachers to that. But we felt there was a balance here with our amount of acres and what we're doing with the farm and the cows and the rotational grazing that puts a limit on how many cows we have here on the farm. So with that, we feel that the cows get a lot of good TLC. And then, you know, when they come in the parlor, you know, we know each one. Our kids, they name every baby that comes, and they are so excited. We get to put their name on their tag, you know. So they're just part of the family.
Name, what was the baby's name of the one that wasn't even dry yet?
Oh, I think that was Bubbles. Yeah.
Bubbles, okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, it's been a couple of days. She's he or she?
She.
She got dried off, I guess, huh?
Yes. Yes, she did. Yeah, she's doing well.
So cute. Now you offer tours, correct?
Yes, we do.
And it's not like I assume that you encourage people to call first?
Oh, yes. We have four children along with all of our farm chores, and different seasons bring different schedules. So with that, we always do scheduled farm tours with people that we do, just so I know that I'm here. I'm not taking someone to 4-H meeting, or if I'm in the parlor milking, that's a very scheduled thing we have to do. You know, I wouldn't be able to stop what I'm doing and give a tour. So, yes, scheduled tours are fine. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And what's your website?
Mm-hmm.
You have a website?
Oh, yes. Yes, www.chapelscreamery.com.
Okay, so Chapel's Creamery as opposed to Chapel's Country Creamery.
Either one. Yes,
either
you
one.
Can type
okay.
either one in, and we have both of those, right.
Okay, and if they can't make it down there,
mm-hmm.
can you
they
order
can
online?
They can order off the website, yes. Yes.
Oh, God.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, as I said, I'm going to do my best to get the... to get it up here, because it'll be interesting for me to approach the cheesemonger at Fairway,
uh-huh.
who they say they have like 300 different cheeses,
wow. yeah.
as to how he chooses the cheese, and you know, and if he's open to trying another. I hope so. I
okay.
sure hope. Well, the thing is. With the tastings of the cheeses that I've done, I prefer a mild cheese.
Mm-hmm.
That's just me.
Right.
And I didn't seem to be tasting enough mild ones. I guess people, you know, I don't know. They like
mm-hmm.
They don't like the mild cheeses.
Mm-hmm.
I guess, you know. And not only that. Personally, I want to push cheeses from the United States. There's enough. We have enough. We don't, you know.
Right.
We don't have to go. We don't need to go foreign.
Oh, no, we really don't. I mean, of course, they do make wonderful, wonderful cheese, you know, but I don't think most people understand how many cheesemakers there are in the United States, you know, like, for instance, when we went to the American Cheese Society conference, you know, there were over 1,700 entries, and those are the
wow.
people that are doing a good job making cheese, you know, good enough that they're going to enter into a national competition, you know. And then, you know, you can go down their list, and if you can go on the American Cheese Society, you know, website and look at the winners, and then you know you're going to get a superior American-made cheese.
Yeah. You don't make butter, do you?
No, I don't.
Okay. I had a fun I had it's funny and he'll be on later, pretty soon. Jordan Lloyd,
yeah.
from Bartlett Pear Inn.
Yeah.
He says he gets, I forgot, he'll tell me where he gets his butter from. He gets it locally.
Mhm.
And I gotta tell you, it's like I couldn't stop eating the bread because of the butter.
Right, right.
It
and
was
that's
amazing.
Another,
and then,
that's another small local herd that's run
yeah.
by a family that puts their cows on the grass, and they have a lot of TLC with that. And then it's made in small batches by hand, and it makes a difference. It's, I think, a whole thing of just going back to basics. A lot of hard work in it, but
yeah.
with that, when your producer is making their own product, they're putting their name on every single item that goes out their driveway. And they put a lot of pride in that.
And by the way, in terms of your, you do go to like farmer market things, right?
Yes.
How about like in terms of the? I'm curious. Are the restaurants in Talbot County? Do they use your cheese?
Oh, they do. Yes,
okay.
they do. And that's. Such a nice thing. We can, you know, go to the farmers markets, and some of the chefs come right by, and they're shopping for things, and we're really proud of that. They're using local products, such as Jordan at the Bartlett Pear Inn. You know, what a superior business he's got going on there, and he prides
oh.
himself in the local products that he uses. You know, he's
yes, that's
good
what
stuff.
That's what really, really impressed me. But yeah. then that's what he's going to come
on. It's
what
he's found locally, and it's great, and it really makes an impact on the entire community. When the community is buying from you and your name is getting out there, and then you create these businesses, and then next thing you know, you're hiring people, and it's just, it makes a big difference economically in your community when you can keep things local like that, and you're all helping each other out, and it just is such a great thing. I guess I get excited over that because I've seen what it has done for our family, you know,
uh-huh.
and the community, and it's a great thing. I really feel I'm more a part of a community now, you know, that people are enjoying our cheeses and yogurts, and they're interacting, and we get to do things, you know. And Jordan and I will actually do things at the farmer's market together. You know, he'll have a chef demo, and he'll use, you know, he made pasta one day at the market. It was incredible. And then he put our feta cheese on it, and it was like, you know, and it just drew people because they got to see what kind of talent is right there in their hometown.
Yes. I'm going to be so hungry by the time I'm done with this show. I have to.
I love it.
But the thing is that you have to agree that buying locally, but making sure that it's quality that you want. In other words, just because
right.
it's local, you know, I mean, it's like, I guess, with getting a local wine.
Right.
I mean, you know, you may not appreciate the wine that's coming from that winery,
mm-hmm.
just, you know, and it's local, but
right.
you're not going to start buying it just because it's local. It's
right.
like you want what you want.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Man, I'm drooling.
I know. It's like, what are we having for dinner anyway, right?
Yeah. okay. Well, I so appreciate it. I will, well, when I write up the article, I'll give out, you know, the information, the phone number to call, and for people to make sure that they, when they're down there, to get a tour, so they can totally appreciate, like, what goes into
right.
Making the products. That's what's interesting.
Right.
Oh, and I wanted to ask you a question, just so people understand. When you have, I mean, there's a difference of people who have a farm that are raising, I guess, would you just call the term cattle for whether it's the cows or bulls or all that? And would you call that is cattle then
mm-hmm.
for terminology?
Yes.
But and there's a difference whether they're being raised so that people are going to be buying meat versus, you know, having dairy.
Yeah, completely different. You have a dairy cow, completely
uh-huh.
different cow than you're going to use for a beef cow.
Okay, so in other words, you don't have to think about that little calf that I saw
mm-hmm.
is going to be sold and cut up and eaten.
We raise them up here on the farm, and 2 years from now they'll have their own calf and they'll be in the milking parlor.
Okay.
For dairy cow, yeah.
Okay.
Now the bulls that are born usually are raised up because there's only so many bulls you can have. The bulls are raised up, not here on our farm, but the bulls are usually raised, and they will be usually raised for beef, but
oh,
not
okay.
females.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so oh, okay. So the and you what I think you had said to me that actually what you're doing is you're not. It's not like you're going to see that the bull and the cow are going to go at it. that you're actually taking the semen from
yeah.
a bull.
A lot of dairy farms do that now so that they don't have the danger of having a bull around. They do artificial insemination, right, is where, you know, there are semen companies. It's a very big, high-dollar business. It keeps the genetics flowing on a farm because, you know, you just don't want to use the same bull over and over and over again. So, you know, it gives you a lot of diversification in your herd and in your genetics by doing AI as artificial insemination. So with these semen, the companies that, that sell this, is they have catalogs out there, and they have all kinds of different breeds that you can choose from and different bulls, you know, genetic and all, in these catalogs, and you can actually order your semen. It comes in a, you know, a tank frozen, and then when a cow is ready, is we can put that in her, and then we will know her exact due date and what kind of cow she'll have.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Not well, yeah, meaning genetic-wise, you know, so we know the pedigree and the background, the family line, the bloodline of our entire herd.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
All right. That's great. Well, I so appreciate your sharing all this information with us. And
sure. It was great to be on the show with you. It was very exciting. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and I look forward to enjoying...
getting those samples. That's correct.
Yes.
Sure.
Okay. Have a great evening. Say hello to the little cows for me.
I will do. Thank
you. And especially say hello to the dog who was who was screaming out, "Ma!
Yeah.
Ma,
that was chocolate.
Absolute, Ma.
Yes.
Don't you understand barking?
She knew something was up and was alerting everyone. Hello, there is a cow out. It does not belong there.
That was
yep,
so
they're
cute.
Smart.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you.
Yeah. And take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. Yeah. We certainly heard the herd. Now, well, let's see. Okay. Well, Jordan, he could be in the middle of something. We want to delete this now. Let's get Jordan on the phone, because, okay, here we go. I ain't telling you his phone number, because I'm going to call him on his cell phone. He's busy, but let's see. Okay, I got the number. Hopefully I'm dialing the right number. It's dialing now. Dialing. Okie dokie. As he's going. Oh, I almost forgot. Or is it this time already?
Hello?
Jordan.
Hi.
Hi, it's Merle Exit.
Good, I was waiting on you. Or maybe you were waiting on me. I don't know.
I was waiting on you.
Oh, well, gosh, I'm sorry.
It's okay. We just finished talking about you, because I was talking with Holly from the creamery.
Oh, cool. Yeah, she's awesome. She is an incredible lady. So hardworking.
Yeah, because we were discussing this whole thing about restaurants using local food.
Oh yeah, absolutely. We are big subscribers to that.
Well, the first thing I wanted, are you busy in the kitchen?
Yeah, absolutely. We have a packed house tonight. We've been pretty fortunate. We have a smaller restaurant, only 30 seats. So on the weekends, we're pretty much booked out, you know, a couple days in advance, if not a little bit further than that.
So I understand what you're saying, because I want to explain to people, is that not only do you use local foods, that you pride yourself on that, it's you're very extremely creative, so that everything that comes out has to be savored.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You can't wolf down your food.
No.
You really have to taste every morsel to really get a sense of how much work you do in the kitchen. How's that?
Well, thank you so much. I love that. That's certainly what I'm thinking about as we're creating it. You know, just getting the most powerful flavors possible on the plate, you know, without overdoing it, you know, without, like, destroying the ingredient, just allowing the ingredient to speak for itself and, you know, really make an impact on the palate just for what the ingredient is, you know, without over-manipulating it.
Right. So how local do you get? Do you try to stick to local, meaning Maryland, or even
It varies from product to product. So I will, you know, if I, like, all of our greens, mixed green salads and turnips and vegetables that are coming out, English peas and, you know, the fun things, you know, asparagus is just about to start popping off. You know, that's all local. That's all within a 10 or 15 mile radius. When we start getting into animals, like we buy whole pigs and whole lamb and we buy rabbits, we stretch a little bit further across Maryland. We work with a company called Feld Point that is basically they're a center for 20 or 30 small farms. So we work through them to pick up these farms like Wagon Wheel Ranch and Nibble Greens. So it's really just about networking and connecting and, you know, getting people to believe in what you believe in so they bring you the products to work with. It stretches a little bit across Maryland, but mostly just within the state of Maryland.
Okay. One of the things, actually you own the inn as well.
I do. Yep, my wife and I together. We're going into our fourth year, the seven-bedroom bed and breakfast. We really treat it more like a boutique hotel. You know, do you have iPods and flat-screen televisions? And, you know, some B&Bs are a little more personal than people care to be, you know. So here it's more of a contemporary hotel, upscale, you know, beautiful, beautiful building, especially for 220 years old.
Really? Wow.
Yep, 220 years old, rock solid, had a lot of love, and we're happy that it's our turn.
Well, I want to make sure I get in some things because I need, like, you know, I look at the plate and I go, wow, what's in there? You know?
Right.
What I want to ask you, first I want to get into the rabbit. So when you get the rabbit, are you getting a whole rabbit that's skinned? Is that what you're getting?
I am. We're getting a whole rabbit. It is skinned. It's from Nibble Green Farms, right outside of Baltimore. Beautiful little farm. And they come to us whole, packaged, beautiful, as fresh as they possibly could be. We bone the whole rabbit. Yep, I'm sorry.
Do you cook up the whole rabbit? And then use, you know, say, okay, this part will be for this thing. I'll use this for that and that kind of thing.
Yep. No, we start from raw. And, of course, you know, a rabbit doesn't have breasts. They have a saddle. So we start from raw, and then we take off the saddle and the leg all together. And then we debone the leg. So now we have this flat piece of meat. And then we continue to pound that leg and the loin, the top loin of the rabbit, into a nice flat portion. And then we actually lay long sticks, julienne sticks of carrots down the center of the rabbit and roll it up just like that and truss it with butcher's twine. And that's a classic technique called Ballantine, a French technique. You know, you can do it with chicken and ducks, but we chose to do it with the rabbit. And then we pan roast it after it's in the appearance of a sausage that's been trussed by butcher's twine. And then cook it just to perfection to about 150 degrees in the center. And then slice it and put it on the plate and serve it with the ravioli. And we make a jus from the bones. So we're using the whole creature, absolutely no waste. We feel that would be disrespectful. And we take the sauce and put that inside the ravioli. So when you cut into the ravioli, the sauce comes out and it all comes together, so you have this beautiful pasta, the ballantine of roast chicken, stuffed with carrots, and then the natto jus.
Wow. I'm getting, I'm after already talking about the cheese, I'm already hungry. But now this is going this is even better. Okay, so that was one of the things I had. What was in the salad? I was looking at a photo of it going, What's in there? I forgot.
Yeah. We have a lot of little accoutrements that go with our green salad. The first thing that's in the salad is love, because it's, you know, the greens are grown by a friend of mine, Will, who just grows the greens specifically for us, Turtle Boy Farms. And they're a compilation of mizunas and tatsaways and some mustard greens and arugulas. So it's just, and what's neat about that salad is I call Will at the end of the night at 11 o'clock in the evening after service, and tell him what I need for the next day, and he picks just what I need for the next day. So we've kind of developed, no, we certainly didn't develop them. I mean, you know, it's a philosophy that's been around for ages, but basically dirt to table in one day. You know, not just farm to table, that's one thing, but actually out of the dirt in the morning and on the table at night. So we really pursue that philosophy with a lot of our ingredients. And this is one where it always happens. You know, it's very consistent for us, which is great. And that's because of the service that Will provides. So along with this salad, we do a lot of pickled vegetables. So we do pickle lily, which is like a turmeric pickled cauliflower. We do some sliced cucumbers and pickled red onions. And there's a little, you know, some pickled carrots and bell peppers on the salad. Then we have this little crispy tuile, little thin cookie that is ingrained with black peppercorn. So that's my version of putting the black peppercorn on top. We actually put it in the form of a crisp cracked tuile that comes across the salad. And it's served with any variation of vinaigrettes. Right now we're doing a raspberry vinaigrette because it's delicious. Sometimes we do champagne. Sometimes we do truffle.
Okay. Now, I'm looking at a photo of Fluke. Wow.
Yep, our North Carolina Fluke.
How would you say that differs from flounder?
It doesn't. It's the style of flounder. It's certainly a flat fish, but in direct relation of the way people think of flounder, it's a lot lighter, it's a lot cleaner, it's a lot more delicate. Only because of its size, really, dictates a lot of that. So we take the fillets off, and then we actually just we put them in a perforated pan with another pan on the bottom that's on top of a light flame, so it steams the fish, and then we cover the fish. And what we steam it with, it's not just water, but it's a court bouillon. So it's we're actually steaming it in a light, you know, fish fumet stock with bay leaf and peppercorn and fresh thyme and fresh garlic and lemon zest. So it's that's what it's being steamed in. So it kind of takes on that flavor as a pork belly would smoke for bacon. This takes on those nuances as it's being steamed and on the plate.
So, and I see there's some on top of it. There's some caviar.
Yeah, exactly. It's nothing too fancy. It's more. It's definitely more of a flavor enhancer. Flavor enhancer. You know, it's a paddlefish roe caviar. So quite inexpensive, you know, in comparison to, you know, Euro Cetras and Cervugas and things of that nature.
And what's the sauce that's underneath?
Beurre blanc. It's a classic butter, you know, white wine and butter sauce. Classically, beurre blanc is done with, white wine. And then a little variation that I guess it's known as, you know, traditional is champagne vinegar. So instead of reducing white wine, we reduce champagne vinegar to get that acid kick, and then lightly whisk in small cubes of cold butter into this reduction of champagne vinegar, and it creates this real, like, satiny, you know, kind of fatty, acidic sauce that lays right across the fish and really just accentuates the whole dish, I think. Beurre blanc is one of my favorite sauces. It's always somewhere on the menu in some form.
Okay, now, on one side, I see, I don't know, what is the combo of? That was really good.
Yeah, it's probably the shimeji mushrooms.
Yeah.
The little, like, white beach mushrooms. And then bacon lardons. You know, let's see, it's probably either fresh herbs and the mushrooms and bacon lardons, I believe.
What is bacon?
Lardons, yeah, pardon me. So we bring in whole pigs, whole animals, and so off the pigs, we obviously take the bellies and turn that into bacon. So we will cure that pork belly for 6 to 7 days, depending on the size of it, and make our own belly bacon and then smoke it. So now you have bacon. Off of that, we do thin little strips and blanch them just lightly. We start them in cold water and bring it to a simmer and strain it, and that releases some of the excess fat in the pork belly. So when you go to sear it, cook it, you have a nice crispy bacon bits, so to speak. Basically, just fancy bacon bits.
Wow, that was
bacon lardons. Yeah, can't go wrong. Fish and bacon and beurre blanc. Woo!
Huh. Now on the other side, there's these fancy vegetables. Now it looks like you've taken, let's see, carrots, yellow,
yep,
and green squash. Not sure.
Yep,
what
maybe
else.
Some Japanese eggplant.
Okay,
so
you like make it into like.
Like a barrel.
Yeah.
So these are our vegetable barrels. This is something that, you know, I certainly did not make up. A lot of the stuff I do here, I don't make up. I mean, it's been done 100 times over. You know, our main focus is just to really just get it done correctly. You know, and this is one item that's classically done by Marco Pierre White, you know, one of my mentors, just an incredible chef, still is today. And it's just julienne vegetables, lightly sweated, and then kind of twisted up into a fork, like almost like you would spaghetti. And
right.
They're seasoned with fresh thyme and natural salt and some nice olive oil, nice finishing oil. And it's just a good presentation of some delicious vegetables.
So if you're looking at a dish like this, sometime way before dinner, you can have, you know, you have, that's the type of thing that's prepped. It's cutting up the, you know, it's not like when I order it and then you start chopping up the vegetables then.
Right. Yep. We use a mandolin, you know, for those particular cuts. We do a lot of stuff by hand, of course, but then a mandolin, you know, which is generally like a steel, you know, cutting tool for vegetables that can make julienne strips and all kinds of different shapes and cuts of vegetables. But it makes it a lot easier. It's basically like a handheld slicer. And it has a grater on it that can produce those long strips of vegetables.
So that
makes our world a little bit easier.
I can't think. Oh, a microplane? Can you use like a...
No, I mean, a mandolin's really the only thing that could replicate that like that, unless you're just doing it by hand very, very carefully.
Right.
But mandolins are available at Williams and Sonoma and some of the, you know, the regular kitchen stores, the upscale kitchen stores. You know, I know a lot of families that, you know, the mandolin is becoming just as much of a staple as a microplane is these days and, you know, other elements of the kitchen.
Okay. Then the next thing is the... And here was a thing that I heard. Now, we had striped sea bass.
That's right.
Now, I'm also hearing it goes under another name.
Rockfish.
Rockfish. So,
yep. Locally, it's known as rockfish. Can't tell you why. I don't know. I grew up around here. It's my hometown. I've always known it as rockfish. But just not one of those things that I ever questioned. Why is it called rockfish? So I'm gonna have to get on my Google when we're done here, so I can get that answer.
What it was. In other words, if I said, "Oh, I just that I had rockfish."
Oh yeah, everyone local to the Eastern Shore would know exactly what you're saying.
Okay.
It would be the same thing as saying I just had wild striped bass.
So tell me.
Or I just had striped bass. Yeah.
Right. So tell me how you cooked that. That looks so good. I'm looking at the photo. Yeah.
Yeah, that's fun. That's English peas, Just coming into season. I mean, not directly around here, but down warmer weather, a little bit warmer. And, you know, it's a simple sauce. I mean, typically tomato vierge is the style. The vierge is the name of the sauce. And vierge is just a compilation of a lot of raw vegetables, basically, raw accoutrements to in a dressing of olive oil and lemon juice. So a lot of times it's tomatoes, olives, capers, basil, parsley, lemon juice, and olive oil. I decided to go English peas in place of tomato and do English peas and olives and lemon segment, olive oil, lemon juice. And you just mix all this together. And the it's easy, you know, as long as you remember the ratio of olive oil to lemon juice, which is just like a vinaigrette, 3-to-1. So you're just making a vinaigrette, you know, three parts olive oil to one part lemon juice. And if it's too acidic for you, you just do a little bit less less lemon juice. So, you know, whatever your palate is the one that's most important.
Now, when you when you're getting the English peas, are they coming in the pod or?
Oh yeah. No, they're coming in fresh in the pods, and we shuck them. And then peas are one of my favorite vegetables and one of the most difficult to cook perfectly. You have to use the big pot blanching method, where it's meaning that you need a very large pot. Pardon me, I was just saying hi to some in-guests.
That's okay.
Yeah, you have the big pot blanching method is where you have a very large pot, salt it, you want it to taste like the ocean, and then you throw your shucked peas in, and the reason you use a large pot is because you want to cook those peas as fast as you can. And if you're using a small pot, when you put your peas in, you're going to lower the water temperature. So it's going to take a longer time than necessary to cook those peas, which means they're going to lose their color before they're fully cooked. So you throw the peas in a big pot of water, make sure it continues to rumble boil the whole time. And then it takes about 10 minutes, and you're looking almost for this creamy puree inside this pea. A lot of people tend to pull them out a little bit early. They still have this little grittiness that you can feel in between your teeth and tongue. You know, they needed to go a little bit longer. Then you pull them out of there and drop them in ice water, and that stops the cooking process. So they're perfectly cooked. They're bright green. They're creamy. And at this point, you can make your vierge, or you can retoss them in a little butter and mint, you know, rewarm them lightly in a sauté pan, and you're going to have perfectly cooked peas every time.
When I grew up, I only knew peas two different ways. It was either you opened up the pot and just ate them, or out of a can and cold.
Oh, good, yeah, sure.
Not even like, you had to have them in the refrigerator.
Really? And you would just eat them raw right out of the pod? Was that
how
it was served for dinner or just because you were shucking them?
No, actually, it was like having them out of the pod, it wasn't even, we didn't have it as part of a meal. It was like, I want something to eat. And then I would go into the refrigerator.
Oh, no, you know, way. Yeah, how about that?
TV or whatever.
It was a snack. Yeah, it was like carrot sticks.
Yeah, but it was like, especially if I was going to watch TV, because it was something to do while I'm watching the TV, you know?
Yeah.
And then I also had learned a certain way of, I think it's the outside of the pod that you could eat, but you first had to, like, pull off a thin skin from the inside.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
And then I would eat that, and it's like, oh, that was really good. And I had the first time somebody put cooked peas in front of me, I went, "Who eats peas that are warm?" You know? I went, "Oh, it's okay. You know, whatever."
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. And the last thing I want to talk about is that cake.
Yeah, it's a devil's food chocolate cake, and I certainly can't take the credit for that. That's our pastry chef, Becca Norris, just a brilliant woman. We're super lucky to have her here. So that's a devil's food chocolate cake, and she's always working on the design of things. And you may have noticed it has this beautiful, like, lace design. And she actually brought in this lace to act as a template to, you know, to coat the top with 10X sugar and then, like, peel the lace off. And then you have all that design on the cake. And it is Tuzasora chocolate is the chocolate she uses, which is a Maryland chocolate company, local chocolate as well. You know, we really push our local ingredients here right down to the chocolate. And this wonderful woman. Yeah, they're in Myersville, right outside of Frederick, Maryland, Myersville, Maryland. And this is Julie McLean, and she owns a gorgeous little chocolate shop right downtown there. And she is the only person in the entire state of Maryland that is actually bringing all the beans from Peru. She has her plots of land in Peru and brings them to her shop and roasts them on site and makes the chocolate and the cocoa nibs and the whole nine yards. And she does all kinds of beautiful chocolate bars and candies and, you know, not candies, but chocolate candies.
I have to write this. What is, say the name of it or spell it?
Yeah. It's Tuzasora. It's S-I-B-U. S-U-R-A. S-I-B-U-S-U-R-A. Tuzasora chocolate. And this chocolate, I mean, it was a no-brainer for me to switch because, you know, I love buying local, but I would never sacrifice quality for local. I'm not going to buy it just because it's local. I like local because of the quality.
We were discussing. I was discussing with Holly in terms of, you know, people buying local, you want to make sure, you know, it's like if it's not what you want, then it's, you know, doesn't pay. Doesn't matter.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know,
but we're fortunate in this area, this region of Maryland, to have amazing purveyors of seriously quality products. I mean, I've been a lucky cook. I mean, I've worked in New York and Miami and Atlanta and D.C. And this area in my own hometown has the nicest, most consistent, highest quality products I've ever had an opportunity to work with in my whole career.
That's
by far.
Great.
Like, no question about it. Not even, you know, not even a debate. It's pretty wonderful.
And let me ask you about, you make your own ice cream, I guess, huh?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yep, everything. There's nothing we don't make. We do our own prosciuttos. We do our own saucy sunsec, ice creams, you know, hand-cut French fries, house-made baguettes. Yep.
And,
I wouldn't be surprised if we start raising our own animals in the backyard here very shortly. We're working on it.
Bread, too, huh?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Even the butter that we serve on the table with the bread is from Nice Farms, also another artisanal local product. Yep. But the ice cream that goes with that chocolate cake is raspberry ice cream. We do a traditional creme anglaise, like a vanilla sauce, you know, using egg yolks and heavy cream and Tahitian vanilla bean. And then bring in raspberries and do like raspberry puree and mix that with it.
And I wanted to ask you, why did the butter taste as good as it did? Just because it's local, or, I mean, it was
absolutely.
Like,
the
I couldn't eat butter the rest of the week. Every place I went to, I didn't eat the butter.
Yeah, two reasons. One, because the pastures that the cows are feeding on makes a big difference in the flavor of the butter. Two, it's the pasteurization process that Bob Miller at Nice Farms uses, where, you know, most major dairies are using a very high temp, quick, like 10-second pasteurization process. So it just forces this milk through these extremely hot pipes or boilers to pasteurize them like in a matter of like 10 seconds, where Bob's pasteurization process is a 3-hour process at a 90-degree temperature, low and low, so you don't lose any of the nutrients and natural flavor of the product. So, you know, the butter that, you know, most of us have available to us, unfortunately, is the stuff that's, you know, people think that butter is not so good for you. Actually, if it's done well, it's great for you. You need it. You know, it's actually healthy.
What's the name of the farm?
Nice Farms, just like it sounds, Nice. N-I-C-E.
Oh, okay.
Yep, Nice Farms Creamery. That's Bob Miller. So yeah, it's just you know, trying to source out the, and the products are out there, but they are expensive. I mean, there's no doubt about it.
Right.
And that's, you know, that's because they're small farm producers. You know, they you know, they're not mass producing, so they can't consolidate
right.
their costs like the big guys can. So it is, you know, it's a pricier product. So it's certainly not for everyone, as it should be, as we all hope it would be. But realistically speaking, you know, that butter that we put on the table is $8 a pound. And you can go to the store and buy just some good old fashioned butter mass produced for $3.
Right.
So, and that's what, you know, restaurants are a very tough business. You know, cutting costs and trying to save every nickel is, you know, a big part of survival. You know, but that's why we're so lucky here that we have a little boutique hotel and just a 30-seat restaurant, so it doesn't take too much for us to book up. You know, we have the ability to get these more, you know, exquisite boutique products on the tables for our guests.
Yeah, and people kind of have to know that this is kind of what to expect. In other words, you're not, as I said, you're not going to, this is not a place to wolf down your food.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. You know, like you said, you know, we don't have large portions here. You mentioned that. You know, that's certainly not our niche, large portions. You know, our niche is, you know, refined dining, you know, without all the stuffiness. There's certainly no snobby people here. We're, you know, you got a restaurant full of farmers who work here. But we do take great pride in our products. You know, and it's more about the, you know, the quality of the flavor and the finesse of the food and the quantity of the products on the plate.
It certainly is. Okay, what's the website, by the way?
Our website is www.bartlettpairinn.com, I-N-N, bartlettpairinn.com. Yep.
Okay, and do you serve, is it only dinner that you serve?
Yep. Dinner only, except for our hotel guests. We do full-scale breakfast for the hotel guests as well. We don't hold back a bit. French press coffee and fresh squeezed orange juices and the whole gamut. But for dinner, we're 5 days a week from Wednesday to Sunday, 5:30 to 10.
Do you get outrageous with breakfast?
Yeah, kind of. We have a bit of a reputation of overdoing it for our in-guests, just because it's fun and we love them. They're our in-guests, you know, they're our hotel guests.
Right.
It's so sweet that they chose us, and we don't take it for granted for a moment. I mean, we're so appreciative when anyone walks through our front door, dinner or in, genuinely. My whole team and I are. We really don't take it for granted. So, yeah, so for breakfast, when guests come down, they have a choice of fresh squeezed juices and French press coffee, and we don't have options as far as, like, a menu because we're just a 7-bedroom inn,
right.
You know, so we don't want to waste food. So we do, you know, we really focus on one particular item every day, and it changes every day. You know, it's Eggs Benedict using house-made brioche and farm-fresh eggs and our own house-cured bacon and hollandaise, or it's, you know, French toast, you know, again, doing our own house-made breads and, you know, using local cream, Tahitian vanilla bean. And we do the real Vermont maple syrup. We're not using the no cheap stuff here.
Yeah.
Those synthetics.
I stopped having pancakes at places because when I tasted real maple syrup, then I said,
yeah.
Oh, now I know what it's supposed to taste like. And if they don't have, I will ask. Do you have real maple syrup? And they'll, you know, if they hem and haw or whatever, and I'll say, you know, no, not maple flavored, maple, you know. Never mind. I'll have eggs. Forget pancakes. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I have a very hard time. I've been such a lucky cook to work for some amazing chefs. That quality was ingrained into my head. There are no shortcuts. You go for the best all the time, and that's the only route to go.
How long have you been open? By the way.
We've got 4 years. We're going into our fourth year now.
And I assume you chefed before at other places.
Oh, yes. Yep. I started as a young cook at 12 years old, washing dishes. Definitely fibbed to my first employer, told him I was 14. You know, I was raised by a single mom, hardworking lady. I didn't want to bother her for money. I'm like, no, mom, I got it. No problem. I'm good. So I snuck in the back door of a little Italian kitchen. You know, the classic story, starting off as a dishwasher. Felt horrible. Told the truth, you know, about a week later, because they were such nice people. And they paid me under the table until I was 14. I was, you know, I was running their kitchen by the time I was 15.
Oh.
And worked there for four and a half, almost 5 years. And then, you know, knew I wanted to go to culinary school and did that, and came back and met my wife at the restaurant right next door to mine now, Mason's, which was my first restaurant out of culinary school.
Really?
So it's really amazing. Yeah, it's awesome to have them as neighbors now. They've always been very supportive of my wife, Alice, and I, and they're just super people. So it's a nice relationship we have across the street from each other. And then I went on to work for Michelle Richard at Citronelle in D.C. for 2 years, and I opened up Thomas Keller's Per Se in New York. I opened up Auberge du Soleil in Bluffton, South Carolina, right outside of Hilton Head. I opened up a major brasserie, French brasserie, with a guy named Christian Delouvrier, better known for his restaurants, Les Panas, and being the chef de cuisine to Alain Ducasse. So I got some really great influence and education and friends out of all that.
Wow.
Yep. I just kind of, it's really special to me. I take a lot of pride in coming back into my hometown and bringing all those wonderful experiences to my people, you know, to my land, to my Eastern Shore, and, you know, using my farmers, my local purveyors, and, you know, just putting my whole heart into all of their ingredients and really trying to get that, you know, get that point across to our guests.
And the other thing I wanted to ask, how often is the menu changed?
Every day.
Oh, so every day? Okay.
Yeah, not totally. It never changes totally. You know, we would totally mess up if we did that every day, and we would never have a good product, because it always takes us a day or two to get the product right where we want it, even after it's on the menu. The first day it's on the menu, it's good. We love it. It's great. Wouldn't be on there if we didn't like it, but it usually takes us, you know, one more day or two more days just to tweak it right to where we want it. Every day something is changing on the menu.
So if I came back in a month, I would have completely different?
It would be completely different. Yep, absolutely.
Okay, so basically it's you can call up and say, what do you have today on the menu?
Absolutely. And, you know, Alice tries to keep up with me on the online, you know, changing the menus online.
Okay.
But she's the real boss here. So she runs this joint. So she is an incredibly amazing, educated, busy lady. So she doesn't always get to it every day, but most days she's right on top of changing it right online on our website.
Oh, okay. Well, that's
yep.
cool. So people can check it out that way.
Right. And whatever's on online is only a couple days behind at the most.
Okay.
Yep.
Well, I appreciate your calling in. Of course, I don't appreciate now that I'm drooling.
Yeah.
But,
well, good. Well, you and your friend were such a joy to take care of, and we really appreciate you coming in.
There's nothing like really, really good food.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, get back to work.
Yes, chef. Yes, chef. Back to work. Well, thank you so much. You have an incredible weekend.
Yes, you too.
Okay, Merle.
Bye.
Yes, ma'am. Bye-bye.
Now I am so hungry. Well, okay. Well, I'm going to leave now because I really, really want to eat. So, as I said, Monday we'll be talking about the art walk. Everybody have a great day.